session number 23216, reel 6.
Colonel Corbould, reel 6. I was asking about Winston Churchill, what impression you got of him when he was visiting.
It was very amusing because the very first impression which I had was standing by the door of the Villa Rivalta, and Field Marshal Wilson came along with the Prime Minister, and said, "This is Captain Corbould, my ADC." And Mr. Churchill took one look at my capstan and said, "Glad to see the Coldstreams here again." And so, because you see, we looked after him at Chequers. And so that was very nice for him to have said that indeed. And my duties there also were security. I had the whole of the security of the Villa Rivalta and all therein, which is quite a responsibility.
Indeed. What forces did you have?
I had a composite platoon of guardsmen.
Composite platoon?
Yes, Grenadier, Coldstream, Scots Guardsmen. Mm. I had all five. And it was a composite platoon. And this required an enormous amount of work, 24 hours a day, particularly when the Prime Minister was staying there.
And how did you go about doing that? I mean, you explained earlier on about what you'd done at Chequers.
Yes.
The Villa Rivalta, was it the same sort of system? Or did you have a different...
Well, no, luckily I had this experience of Chequers, but of course this was a different kettle of fish, in that we had no open ground around at all. It was right on the Bay of Naples. And so one spread the guardsmen out, and one just simply went round and patrolled day and night.
Presumably then you would have had a section or so on duty.
Oh yes. There was a section on duty 24 hours a day.
Was there ever any sign of a threat to the security of the villa?
I didn't get one, no. I didn't get one at all. But I didn't have to have a sentry outside the Prime Minister's room or anything like that. Mm. Although, of course, I went past it time and time and time again. very amusing indeed. One night I was going through doing my rounds. Oh, this was about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And I came across the house sergeant, a man called Trailer by name, a rifleman in the Rifle Brigade. This is when I was with Field Marshal Wilson. And I said to him, "Trailer, what on earth are you doing? Where are you going?" He said, I'm in a great hurry, sir. He said, "I just went outside, a very sticky Neapolitan night, and I was going past the Prime Minister's window, and the window shot up, and he put out his head and said, bring me a bottle of iced white wine. I'm asking what to get the iced white wine, sir."
So, what were the duties of the House Sergeant? What was his...
Well, he was like the mess sergeant would be.
Ah.
He had to provide all the meals and write the menus, and which all, of course, were vetted by Hermione Ranfley. And so, he was a very busy man indeed, ran the mess account, all that sort of thing, yes.
So he was really rather like the butler.
Exactly like a butler, yes, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Did you actually dine with the field marshals when they were in residence, or...?
Not all the time, from time to time. Mm. But not in the villa, mainly at the little village, the little cottage which Field Marshal Alexander had up in the woods, yes, outside Caserta Palace. Yeah.
What had that cottage been used for, do you know, before the Field Marshal went into it?
Well, it was an adequate, I suppose it was just a country cottage. Mm. I mean, what had been used for before that, I have no idea at all, but it suited the Field Marshal very well indeed. Seemed to having to go from between Naples and Caserta all the time.
What about Field Marshal Wilson? Had he lived in the Villa Rivalta, or had he lived in the palace at Caserta?
I think he lived in the palace at Caserta, yes.
Have you any idea why it was that Field Marshal Alexander preferred the cottage in the woods?
But he was a man who liked to be on his own a good deal, other than with just a very, very few people. Mm. He was a very quiet chap, indeed. And... he had this incredible look about him. He had these very piercing blue eyes. He'd look at you, maybe he wouldn't say anything at all. It was rather terrifying. Mm. And if you said something, he'd say, "I see," or something like that. That was about all. Wasn't it? Mm. But he was he was friendly to a certain extent. And I dined with him before I went back to the battalion and sat on his right at dinner. And he was absolutely delightful then, yes. Anyway, so getting on to... Now, who else did we have... of the guests. And we had Mrs. Claire Luce Booth, the American... She eventually became the American ambassadress at Rome. And that was most amusing. She gave me a golden $1 piece as a memento. And I don't know, she said, last person I gave one of these to was General MacArthur. Well, I take that with a fistful of salt. But I've got the medal to this day. And I hung it on my chain around my neck. It was throughout the war, when I wore an identity disc.
Yes.
And I stuck it onto that. And it's still there to this day. There were all sorts of other people came along as well. Generals. We had quite a number of generals out from England, of course. Including General Lloyd, who was what we call the Major General from London. He came out.
Did any of them make any particular impression on you? Because being an ADC gives a good post for observation, doesn't
well,
it?
Yes. I mean, I'd met, of course, General Lloyd before, but a very impressive man. Again, a very quiet man, indeed. We had also General Paget, who was in charge of Home Forces, and whose son, to this day, is one of my very greatest friends.
This be Sir Bernard Paget?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, his son, Julian, is one of my very, very great friends, and he's also a Coast Dreamer. And, yes, so he came out, and...
It's been said to Sir Bernard Paget, by some who saw him, that he was normally quite short-tempered, except when he was in action, and then he became perfectly calm and content.
He had a very short fuse, indeed.
Yes.
A mighty short fuse. He stayed for about a week with us, something like that. Mm. But I didn't get the short fuse blown at me, but I played my cards very close to my chest.
did you see anything of General McCreary? Was he...
Saw him in the line. We were in... Yes. He commanded 10 Corps.
Mm. But later on, he commanded the 8th Army, didn't he?
That's right.
Towards the end.
That's right, towards the end. Yes. After General Lees had gone off to the Far
right.
East.
Yes.
You know, I remember General McCreary, because I think their corps sign was a red ball with a red band underneath. They were known as the Ball and Bar Bastards.
So what about Harold Macmillan? Did you see anything?
Yes, I saw a lot of him.
What did you make of him?
Oh, he was a wonderful man. Now, I used to go and have dinner with him and Lady Dorothy regularly, because he had an MA called Rafe Anstruther, who, in fact, Rafe Anstruther, for years and years and years recently, has been the Queen Mother's treasurer, and was with the Queen Mother for something like 30 years. Not a very well man. No, I'm afraid to say. But Rafe was a great friend, and he'd been a great friend of my brother Paul in the second Coldstream as well. And yes, and they lived in the villa around the corner from us at the River Valta. And I used to go and dine with him a lot. He was a wonderful man. And my last, at the unveiling in London of Field Marshal Alexander's statue at the Guards Chapel, I suppose, 1985, something like that. And he was there. And I made a point of going up and speaking to him. And I said to him, how was he? He said, I mentioned about being with the field. Oh, he said he knew I was ADC of the field marshal. And I said, well, what are you doing today, sir? So he said, well, I'm going down to the house, he said, to try and bolster up this teetering government. That was when Margaret Thatcher was the Prime Minister, which I found rather amusing. But yes, he was he was a terrible man he was very bad at keeping time. And the number of times I had to ring up, particularly when Churchill was there, I'd have to ring up Rafe and say, will you get your Lord and Master around here now, N-O-W, they're waiting for him. And in he'd come, tearing in his car, switch of brakes, out he'd get and shoot him and say to me, oh, I'm so sorry.
In his diary, it seems that he would occasionally get himself exhausted and he'd take to his bed for a day or so and just rest.
I don't know about that at all. Because he suffered from wounds from the First World War throughout the rest of his life.
Yes, yes. And we've also always said that Churchill had rather irregular working hours. He'd stay up very late at night and then he'd get up late.
Oh, yes. Well, you must read.
Do work in bed, too.
Oh, he would. Now, Nigel, what you must do, you must read the Addenbrooke Diaries, published, last year. And that'll give you the whole inside picture of all that sort of way of life, yes. Mm.
But it seems to me Macmillan was sort of adopting the same sort of habits, really, that he would, you know, sometimes he'd have to work very late indeed.
Yes.
But he would compensate by occasionally not bothering to get out of bed if he didn't need to.
Well, that I don't know. But another guest we had, of course, was Tito.
Oh.
And that was very interesting indeed. You will probably remember from your history of the Italian campaign that that General Anders, a marvellous man who I also met.
Polish general.
Polish general, yes. Marvellous man. and who'd been taken prisoner by the Russians with his AEC called Prince Lubomirsky. They'd been taken prisoner and kept in a cell below ground level in freezing cold weather and so on until the Russians came onto our side. And he, Anders, at one stage during the Italian campaign, threatened to withdraw the Poles from the battle line because he could see Poland as being carved up. Why am I fighting the war? And this is when Churchill was with us. And so Churchill had to persuade him to do differently. So he took that, but then he came up again later on. He again said to the Field Marshal, I'm going to withdraw these Poles from the line. And he was sent back to England. And I had to see him off from Naples on a Saturday morning to go and see Churchill. And a very dejected Anders came back on Monday morning, but the Poles have not taken out of the line.
Presumably he'd had the riot act.
I think he'd had the riot, yes. But a very dejected man indeed, yes.
What impression did you get of Tito when he turned up?
Well, he'd be an impressive man indeed. I also went with the Field Marshal to his headquarters in Yugoslavia, too.
What was that like? Where was that?
Well, that was sort of in a cave out in, not very far from Belgrade. And thereby hangs another story, because at that time I flew in with, that time I wasn't a parachutist, so I flew in with Fitzroy MacLean and Randolph Churchill, and we flew into Belgrade and then made it out to his headquarters before the Field Marshal actually arrived.
Had they got an airfield for you?
Yes, yes. There was a rough airfield.
Clandestine.
Yes, that sort of thing, yes. And I took some of my guards with me as well, who had to be doing security work and so on. And so we were with the Field Marshal came out, and this particular night we were all in this huge cave with bucky lamps on the tables and so on, and conferring with Tito, and all the things were agreed that what the partisans would do and the help with which they would get. The conference ended, and so Fitzroy MacLean turned to the Field Marshal and said, now he says, I've got a thing which I must talk to you about. We have captured a Yugoslav woman, and she is a spy. And she has been responsible, I think, for a lot of deaths and so on and so forth. And quite honestly, she must be shot. But I don't have any, I don't have the permission to do that. Therefore, I'm asking you permission to shoot her. And the Field Marshal kept quiet and suddenly looked up and said, no, no, he said, Fitzroy, that won't do. Women were born to have babies. Only men were born to be shot. And that was the end of that. So if she's alive to this day, she'll be a very old woman. But she will owe her life to Field Marshal.
His anti-feminist views.
But I think what he possibly thought of was Nurse Edith Cavell of the First World War when the Germans shot her. He wasn't going to have the same thing happen there. And rightly so.
Do you know what they were discussing with Tito, what the issues were that they had to settle at the conference?
I don't. I wasn't really privy to that.
Privy to the conference
I was
itself.
Not privy to the conference itself, no.
Did Tito have the same sort of headquarters set up as we would have had with wall maps and...
No, he didn't seem to, no. It seemed to be all in the head.
In his mind.
And he was a brilliant man, there's no doubt about that at all. And he had a chief of staff, whose name I can't remember at all. I've got a photograph of him at home. But, no, he had a complete sort of... He was a supreme commander of his own forces. Yeah. I mean, quite honestly, when you came across the Yugoslavs, I was in hospital beside one, and I swear it was... I don't know whether it was a man or a woman. I mean, it's very difficult to tell the difference between the two. The women looked as rough as anything else, you know. And he was asked, I know, on one occasion... what do you do about having men and women in the line together? When men and women get together, certain things are bound to happen. Oh, yes, he said, I do a certain thing. Oh, what's that? And he said, well, the woman, if she becomes pregnant, is sent off into the hills to have the baby. The man gets shot. And that rather cools their ardour. That's quite a thing to do, isn't it? Imagine that happening today.
He obviously didn't share Field Marshal Alexander's tender regard.
So the other way on.
What sort of security measures did you have to take when you were guarding this conference?
Well, it was, we had military police as well, and there was one military police sergeant who was in charge of the field marshal. And he, wherever the field marshal went, he was armed, this chap.
So he was a personal bodyguard?
Personal bodyguard, yeah, yes.
Mm. And your guards, what did they do?
They were also doing their rounds outside the caves and so on and so forth.
Picketing,
yes. Mm. Mind you, because we had to be very careful, it didn't upset the Yugoslav partisans.
Well, I was going to ask about relations with them, because presumably they would have provided security for Tito.
That's right. And they wanted to be quite certain that these chaps didn't get the wrong impression.
Yes.
You see, right at the very end of the war, at a place called Monfalcone, we almost had a punch up with the Yugoslavs. Mm. I mean, they were very trigger happy indeed. And I spent the VE day, for example, sighting section positions against the Yugoslavs, because they'd come right round through the Venezia-Guilia line, and they were going to get stuck into Trieste.
Oh, well, they're obviously out to get as much territory as they could, weren't they, by that stage? So were relations with them tricky at the stage you went to Tito's cave?
Not so tricky then, not so tricky as it was later on. They were very tricky later on, which I got at battalion level, of course.
Yes. But when you were ADC, things were going on a business line.
On a business line, because you wanted as much as you possibly could from the British.
Naturally.
And you got it, too.
Yes. And what did the Field Marshal seem satisfied with the outcome of the conference?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Oh, yes.
Did he attend on his own, or did he take Harding with him?
No, he took Lyman Lemnitzer, who was the Deputy Chief of Staff.
The American.
The American. Mm. That was quite amusing. We were taken to see what had happened to a German armoured column up in the woods, and I tried to think of the name last night, again with A, but I just can't remember the name of the place now. And we were taken to see what had happened to this German column. Not a pretty sight. And we were discussing tactics and so on and so forth, and Lyman Lemnitzer was a delightful man, but he could go it with the tongue, you know. And I suddenly saw, it was a very snowy day, and I suddenly saw the field marshal go off into away from the throng, with old Lyman Lemnitzer talking 19 of the dozen. And suddenly a snowball pitched on Lyman Lemnitzer's neck from the field marshal, who said, Lemmy said, I think we've heard just about enough now, thank you very much indeed.
Puts a perspective on inter-allied relations.
Yes.
Did Lem mind?
No, not at all. No. He worshipped the ground, the field, as we all did. Worshipped the ground he walked on.
How did you get back to the battalion then after this?
Well, then I made myself become very fit indeed again. So when I was really fit and I ceased to hobble and so on and so forth, all my shows, everything was working. I got back to the battalion ready to cross the Po.
How did you prove that you were fit? Did you have to go to a board?
No, Dolly Fair. I wasn't going to take that risk.
You weren't?
I just pronounced myself fit. And I said to Bill Cunningham, who was the MA to the Field Marshal, look, yeah, I'm perfectly fit now. I must go back to the battalion.
And what did he say?
He said, okay, fine.
I let you go.
Let me go. And I handed over to a grenadier. Mm.
So this sounds really rather like a time in Shangri-La when you were down in the...
Oh, yes, it was. Area. Oh, yes, I mean, it was the lap of luxury.
But you didn't want the luxury.
Well, I was quite pleased to have a bit of luxury, I must confess. But it was a most interesting job to have.
Yes.
And meeting all these people.
Mm. Well, regarding security, with whom were you liaising for that? Did you have contact with... was there a sort of security organisation at the Supreme Allied Commander's headquarters?
Only with whom? I suppose there was a certain liaison between the military police and the local carabinieri and so on. Yes. But could you trust them?
Well, this was another question, isn't it?
That I don't know at all. But I mean, I made my own plans. I told the military police what I was doing, and they all seemed quite happy. Yes.
I mean, did you ever get any sort of hints that there might be a threat that could develop from
Oddly
the
enough,
military
I didn't.
Police?
Oddly enough, I didn't. Not even when we had Churchill there.
Yes. Because, by this stage, the Italians were formally, at any rate, our allies, weren't they?
Oh, yeah, they meant to be, yes.
Did you see any high-ranking Italians turning up at the headquarters?
I never saw one. Mm. I never saw one at all, no. Mm. They kept a fairly low profile after September 43, when they capitulated. Mm. But could you trust them? And they said, you've never, ever found any Italian to say that he was a fascist. Mm. Oh, no.
Naturally.
Mussolini needed Buono.
Well, you said the battalion were on the Po when you rejoined them, so yes. That's right up on the Adriatic side,
yes.
Isn't it?
That's right, yes. Yeah. Well, just before they crossed the Po. Yes. Mm. And we had a fairly unopposed crossing of the Po.
How did you get across it? What
in dinghies.
Assault
craft.
You were saying fairly unopposed. But does that mean there was some opposition?
Well, there was some, but yes, obviously the inevitably the shelling. Mm. But we didn't come across any sort of very angry men in grey, as we used to call them. But at that particular time.
Yes. So how wide was the Po at the point you crossed it? It's a large.
It's a very large river indeed. Yes. The width of it. Do you know, I wouldn't like to hazard a guess, Nigel, I'm afraid.
Did you go over, were your boats powered or were you paddling?
No, they were powered.
Powered?
Yes.
Who was doing that for you? Was that the Royal Engineers running them?
The Royal Engineers. We went in company by company, platoon by platoon.
Yes.
It, I don't know, 1,000 yards, would that make any sense at all?
Well, yes, that would be rather narrow at that point. I would have thought it might have been...
More than that, but 2,000 yards.
A bit wider, yes.
Yes.
Of course, the Germans had engineered it to spread it
as
well,
had,
make the bank soggy.
Yes. Oh, yes, yes. Mm. But we had one of the last things that happened, it was very unfortunate indeed. We were going along in TCVs, and the Germans suddenly opened fire down this road with 88s.
Oh.
And they knocked out two of our, this was in April 45, a month before the war ended.
Yeah.
And we had a whole lot of guardsmen killed. On that particular occasion, when they had a direct hit on two TCVs, a lot of whom had been in my platoon.
It's very bad luck. What did they do with you when you got back to the battalion? Did they give you back the same platoon, 16 platoon, or presumably you were a captain?
No, I was
now.
A captain. I was company second in command of number four company.
Number four company. You didn't go back to second to
no, 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 no. I was a company second in command. Yeah. Yeah.
What are the duties of a company second in command as you had to carry them out?
Well, it's mainly the administration of the company, and of course in battle you alternate between the company commander and yourself. Mm. And you've got to be able to do the job one hour.
So effectively you're a deputy really
in
battle.
Yes.
Out of battle you're the business manager.
The business manager makes sense in all the administration of the company generally, and the men are under control, all the sort of men's welfare. Mm-hmm. Very important.
What sort of welfare measures did you take then to ensure that they were?
Well, you could tell by talking to the chaps just normally, and one would go around and chat to them at any time. If they were worried about, perhaps they were complaining about the food, or very few complaints about the food, because we were on sort of, what do they call them, K rations or something like that.
American rations?
Yes, yes. And then, of course, the great thing was the home. Had they heard from home? Had mum and dad written in, or had the wife written? And that's very important indeed. And of course, we used to write to the mums and dads and the wives as well. And we had nearly every time one would get replies back.
Did the mail come up effectively?
Yes,
and, well?
yes. Mm. Yeah, the mail came up. Mm. On one particular occasion, we had a letter which had been posted in London that morning. Mm. That did morale a power of good.
Amazing. Mm. You mentioned food. I mean, were you able to supplement the rations with anything purchased locally?
I don't know.
Or obtained locally.
I think obtained locally is the correct thing to say. Yes. Yeah, I think we did obtain quite a bit, yes. But one had to be rather careful. We were out on the countryside, of course. There were quite a lot. These Italians were not starving, I can assure you.
No, well, people living in the country... Don't stop.
And the chap who looked the best fed of all was the local curé. Mm. Oh, he was very well fed.
Well, you've got to look after your spiritual advisor.
Yes.
So you crossed the Po, and you presumably didn't run into any infantry on the far side.
Not on the far side, no.
And then you...
Then, as far as I remember, we didn't have any more now until that terrible incident. We had this 88 flying straight down the
right towards the end.
Line. Yeah. Yes. Right towards the end, yes. Yeah.
And were you heading towards Venezia Giulia?
Yeah, we were.
Into Istria.
And we got as far as Monfalcone.
Yes.
And that's where we finished the war, in Monfalcone. And oddly enough, there was a 2nd New Zealand Armoured Division there. Mm. And on that day, I shared half a can of beer with... troop leader in the New Zealand Armour Division, and my orderly, the three of us. We had a sip of beer each. And my orderly was an extremely fit man. And he said, I think I should walk round in a circle now on my hands, sir. And he did, to celebrate V Day. Yeah. That's all the V Day celebrations that we had.
Do you happen to know where it was that you encountered these destructive 88s that were firing straight down the road?
It was short of Monfalcone.
Short of Monfalcone. Yes. This was the last gasp.
That was the last gasp of the Germans. They knew they'd absolutely had it then. There was no point in continuing any further at all.
Did you catch up with them?
No. But the next thing was, of course, it was the Yugoslavs.
Yes.
That was the next thing.
How did that situation develop then? You've got well, Monfalcone with your New Zealanders.
That's right. And then suddenly there's a herd of Yugoslavs arriving. Yes. What the hell's going on here? Then orders came through from GHQ, from the Field Marshal. I got the little slip of paper we sent round to us all that we could well be continuing the war. Mm-hmm. And if the Yugoslavs don't go back behind this Vinica-Guida line, I shall order you all to open fire. Then we would have been in another battle contest. Mm. And they were all round at every street corner, these trigger happy jugs.
But you're in town.
Oh, yes.
Mm. What sort of town was Montfalcone? What condition was it in?
It was all right. It had been bombed a bit, but shelled a bit. But it was all right. It was quite a pleasant sort of place. And it was quite near the sea, as far as I remember.
Mm. So you might have got involved in street fighting with the.
Oh, we could easily.
The jugs.
Oh, yes. Very much so. Mm. Anyway, I went round as company second in command. I did all the sighting of the section positions.
Oh. How would you choose a good section position in circumstances like that? What would you look for?
Fields of fire. Mm. Good fields of fire.
Were you putting people into buildings?
No, we were digging in.
You were digging in round them?
We were digging in round them, yes, yes. And it was to be a fully held defensive position.
Do you have any artillery in support?
Oh, yes.
With your Ayrshire Yeomanry?
I don't know whether it was the Ayrshire Yeomanry then. I don't know whether they were still with us. I don't know. Mm. But said we had artillery support, yes, yes.
And how was that situation resolved? What happened?
Well, it all faded away. Suddenly, the Yugoslavs disappeared. Ah. Someone obviously gave the order. I suppose politics came into it a good deal. Mm. Probably back in this country. I don't doubt the Churchills.
Well, presumably Belgrade or something like that.
Belgrade or something like this. Anyway, suddenly the Yugoslavs disappeared. Mm. Thank God. Mm. But they were very trigger happy indeed.
Mm. Did you have any personal contact with them?
Well, except one couldn't, because you couldn't speak their language at all.
But I mean, some of them spoke English, I think, didn't they? Some
of the none of the chaps that I
none of the ones you
came
met.
Across, no. Mm. And they were all as rough as goat's knees and in a terrible state. They were just absolute bandits, complete bandits.
But they're our bandits, or had been our
they had
bandits.
Yes.
How long did that go on for, that period of tension? Do you remember?
I think it went on for about, I was no more than a fortnight. Mm. No more than a fortnight.
How did the Guardsmen respond to the idea of starting a new war against the former ally? What did they think about that?
I didn't even ask them at all. It was just a job as far as we were concerned. Mm. We've been used to killing people. We were quite prepared to go on killing people, if need be, in our own defence. No, I never asked the guys what they thought about it at all, but obviously we were, after VE Day, we thought, well, this is marvellous. We won the war.
It's all over.
It's all over. Mm. But it could not, it might not have been.
Yeah.
That's about all I can say about that, I think.
Yes.
Really. Then the next thing was everything quietened down, and I got sent for by the commanding officer, who said to me, how are you doing?
Fine.
Who said to me, would you like the last chance in your life ever to serve in India? So I said, yes, I would, thank you very much, but what's the form? They wanted guardsmen to go and be the adjutant at the officer's training school in Bangalore. So I got sent off there.
How did you get out there?
By troop ship. I was sent back to this country, of course. And
to Britain.
To Britain, then regrouped, as it were, and took off to India with another co-streamer and a